You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Last week, oil from a grounded container ship spilled into the waters of Howe Sound near Squamish, killing birds and fouling beaches. It was just one of the hundreds of oil spills that occur in waterways around the world every year. Scientists once believed that after the initial devastation of an oil spill, the toxic residue quickly disappeared. But 17 years after the infamous Exxon Valdez disaster, communities around Alaska's Prince William Sound still struggle with the lasting impact of the disaster. Ricky Ott is a marine biologist and toxicologist in Cordova, Alaska. Prior to the Exxon Valdez spill, she worked as a commercial fisher. In the years since, she has worked to document the lasting effects of oil on the environment, human health, and her community. The results of that research is her new book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths: The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. And Ricky Ott joins me on the line now from Cordova, Alaska. Hello, Ricky.
Good morning, Mordecai. Thank you for inviting me.
Why did you write this book?
Well, about 1992 and 93, the fish runs started to collapse in Prince William Sound. And fishermen suspected it was because the fish initially exposed in 89 were having trouble reproducing. So we thought we were seeing potentially long-term effects. That's not what the scientists were telling us. So our reality began to diverge quite a bit, you know, from what we were seeing in Prince William Sound, lingering harm in the environment, residual oil on the beaches, with what Exxon was saying. Exxon was saying everything was fine, recovery had been rapid, everything was back to normal. And so I thought, I better take a look at what the individual researchers are finding and start piecing this together.
When you did your academic training in toxicology and biology, what it seems you were taught about toxic effects of oil was very, very different from what you were finding in your area after the Exxon Valdez. How is oil more dangerous than we once thought?
Well, you got to go back to 1970s and realize that when the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act passed back then, it was based on science that only looked at one fraction of oil. Oil is composed of hundreds of different hydrocarbons, and the compounds that were focused on 30 years ago were the volatile organic carbons. These are ones like when you fuel up your car with gas, you kind of get that sweet, sticky smell. The VOCs, they're called, evaporate quickly into the air and dissolve quickly into the water. So that was the sole focus. And if you just look at that, well, oil does have a very short-term effect. What we found, though, in Prince William Sound was, well, let me first explain that because the damage was so extensive in Prince William Sound, there was a huge penalty, $900 million, for damages to natural resources. Wildlife, wild land. So with that money, scientists then could actually study the Exxon Valdez. Most spills are studied 1 year, 2 years, that's it. So Exxon Valdez allowed scientists time to actually look over a decade. What happened to multiple generations? What happened to multiple species? How the food web interacted with oil? And as a result of this, scientists found that a completely different fraction of oil, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, the stuff that lingers on the beaches, is actually a prime culprit in causing lingering harm. Lingering harm in the meaning of reproductive problems, immune suppression, so you get very sickly animals. And if you get enough sickly animals, enough immune suppression problems, enough reproductive problems, on individuals, eventually it affects the population. So we really were looking at a different oil fraction from 30 years ago, and that fraction, the PAHs, cause more harm, cause a very different kind of harm over the long term. And I just want to add that those PAHs are found in soot. So like coal smoke, oil smoke, burning oil fields like the Gulf War vet, even PAHs come from the exhaust of our automobiles.
Now, there's also, I gather, a human health effect of the spill on the people who volunteered to do the cleanup. What kinds of things have those workers and people experienced?
The cleanup workers on the Exxon Valdez have experienced very similar illnesses to the Gulf War vets who were exposed to the burning smoke from the burning oil fields. And they... most of the workers in 1989 had acute symptoms that mimicked cold and flu-like symptoms, so respiratory problems, coughs, achy, headachy feeling. And a lot of the workers thought those feelings, you know, they would get better once they quit the cleanup. And to the surprise of many of them, they didn't. This resulted in a number of lawsuits, toxic tort lawsuits. On a parallel note, the medical researchers since 1989 have also been realizing that these PAHs, the same thing that caused the animals harm, also harm humans. Again, it's this particulate inhalation, this kind of soot-like stuff. And enough medical research accumulated so that the EPA in 1999, 10 years after Exxon Valdez, listed 22 of the PAHs in crude oil on the same list of human health hazards as lead, dioxin, mercury, PCBs, and DDT. And this is huge. We don't put any of these other substances, with the exception of PAHs, in the gas tanks of our cars. I mean, essentially what this finding means is that it's time to seriously consider taking the gas out of the gas tanks of our cars. That's really what this means. And what the medical science and wildlife science are pointing to is that these PAHs persist in the environment for a long time. They travel through the air, water, soil, food. They are a bioaccumulate, that is, they accumulate in the buildup, in the flesh of vertebrates, us, birds, fish, mammals. And they also cause toxic effects. And again, it's not the knock over dead thing, but it's kind of making a person more sickly over time and less able to, less talking about quality of life here, talking about genetic problems, reproductive problems, respiratory problems, and even cancers.
You worked in the fishery in Prince William Sound. How did the spill affect specifically that industry?
Well, that has been an ongoing tragedy, unfortunately. In 1992 and 1993, so 3 and 4 years after the Exxon Valdez, a pink salmon run collapsed in Prince William Sound. And scientists were later able to track this to lingering oil, buried oil, pits, reservoirs of oil on the beaches from the Exxon Valdez spill that washed into the eggs and the young juvenile fish and affected their growth and their survival. Subsequently, as the oil degraded on the beaches over time, the pink salmon runs eventually recovered. The herring have not. And herring, like pink salmon, spawn intertidally. They spawn on the beaches. And where the beaches were oiled, the herring were also exposed to oil at very early developmental stages. And unfortunately, herring have a different life cycle than salmon. They live 11 years. This has, in hindsight, scientists conducted studies that found a link between the early oil spill effects and later disease outbreaks. The herring have not been able to recover from these disease outbreaks, and herring are the cornerstone species in Prince William Sound. They're the sort of the bottom of the food web. And without herring, we've started to see other birds, mammals, and fish suffer indirect effects now from the Exxon Valdez. So it's still quite a mess here, and I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that it's never going to recover. We are seeing areas that were lightly oiled and moderately oiled come back. We're still having problems with areas that were most heavily oiled. And the federal scientists are now saying that they expect another 20 years or so before the oil actually degrades and disappears.
In your book, you also describe a difference in effect of disasters which are human-caused, like the Exxon Valdez spill, and disasters that are natural, like a flood or earthquake. What is that difference in community and social response to those two different kinds of disasters?
Well, I don't want to fool readers into thinking that they're going to learn about that in this book. I allude to it, but I'm actually writing another book now that fully explains this because it's so significant. The sociologists at the time of the Exxon Valdez also had based their science and models for emotional trauma mitigation on 1970s science. And that science had all been done off floods, fires, and earthquakes. True, those things are disasters. But then along came Love Canal, then Bhopal over in India, then Chernobyl in the Ukraine. And the sociologists were really surprised to discover that the effects, there were also lingering harm with emotional trauma. And so the scientists were just starting to say, well, what's going on here when we had the Exxon Valdez? Cordova became a case study for sociologists. We're sort of guinea pigs here to kind of model and figure out what really is the difference between what is now known as two types of disasters. In natural disasters, there's no one to blame. You can't blame God. So people tend to go, okay, a fire destroyed my home. My neighbors are going to help me rebuild. And, you know, my trauma is pretty short term. So, you know, everybody worked together to put out the fire, and it actually built trust and built community. What's happening in these technological disasters is that there's someone to blame. So it ends up being very divisive and bitter, and people are fighting over who should or shouldn't have done what, their lawsuits, and the emotional trauma goes on and on and on. For example, in the Exxon Valdez, 5 days after the spill, Exxon came into town and said, you are lucky you have had Exxon. We do business straight. When your nets don't fill up with fish, we'll compensate you. When your motels go bankrupt, we'll pay you for your losses. They didn't say, we will fight you in court for every single claim and appeal everything, which is what they've done for 17 years. So it turns out the sociologists have found that this litigation trauma also creates basically a secondary disaster. So it's a very divisive, corrosive community that pops out, and the harm, there's emotional trauma models now, but this harm is not established it's not recognized in the legal system. There's no way to make spillers compensate for this kind of thing, and so I'm trying to emphasize all this in my next book, is that how unprepared we small communities are really in the face of these technological disasters to truly get compensated for all we've lost.
Well, it's been terrific speaking with you this morning, and it's certainly information that's very, very relevant to us here in British Columbia, with the government trying to lift a moratorium on offshore oil and gas development. I'll point people to your book, and we'll look forward to the second one as well. Thanks again, Ricky.
Thank you very much, Mordecai, and I encourage all the communities to insist that their values and their quality of life count. So good luck with everything.
Thank you for that, too. Bye-bye, Ricky.
Hi, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Ricky Ott. She's author of a book called Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. The book is published by Dragonfly Sisters Press. If you want more information, you can go to the following website, soundtruth.info.